Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 12th of December 2015. My name's Hereward Fenton. Welcome aboard. Well, today, folks, I'm looking at predominantly the Islam question because this has now really come to the forefront of discourse about what is going on in the Middle East, the imperial wars that are being fought, and questions about democracy and freedom. Suddenly, it seems after all these years, the central questions about Islam are now really center focus for looking to the future for a better type of world, a more peaceful, democratic, free civilization for the future than what we currently have. And of course, we've got two problems here. We've got the problem of the imperial threats from within Western civilization, which are increasing and must be dealt with on their own terms. And we must always acknowledge that these imperial agendas have worked to manipulate and use other cultures, particularly intolerant, violent cultures such as militant Islam, as a weapon to achieve their ends. We must always keep that in center focus. But of course, we also have to look at the reality of militant Islam. And interestingly, in the last week, Australia's former Prime Minister came forward in a TV interview and said some quite strident comments about this problem, which caused a lot of uproar in Australian politics and led him to be accused of being Islamophobic and, you know, engaging in hate speech and all this kind of stuff. Whereas, in fact, he was simply raising some very important key issues. And I'll actually just play some of that for you. And then I actually want to talk more about the other aspects of this that are not greatly discussed, that don't tend to come up in the news, which is that there are forces at work within Islam which are a counterbalance to the militant extremist Wahhabist groups that seek to impose a global caliphate which would impose Sharia law and basically murder infidels. There are very, very strong and powerful elements within Islam that are totally opposed to that agenda. So I want to get back into that. But let's begin by looking at the recent comments of former Prime Minister of Australia, Tony Abbott. Here we go.
Islam has never had a reformation, an enlightenment, a well-developed concept of the separation of church and state. That needs to happen, but we can't do it. Muslims have got to do this for themselves. What was so wrong with allowing our universities the freedom that they need to be the best in the world? What was so wrong with seeking a modest co-payment?
I shall just leave it there. Those little snippets there about Islam caused a huge uproar in Australian media and Australian politics. And indeed, Malcolm Turnbull, the current Prime Minister who replaced Tony Abbott, censored Tony Abbott for having made those comments. And the Leader of the Opposition said some things that indicated that he was deeply offended by what Tony Abbott had said. Grossly disrespectful to Muslims. That was the comment from the Islamic Council of Victoria spokesman Karunda Sayed, who said Islam is a religion of decency and has equally to any other religion in the world the highest moral standards which we uphold. Now, there is a problem here. There is a problem with the way this is being framed, with the way our own media in Australia is presenting the information. And it's a problem echoed around the world. It's a problem in every mainstream media coverage of this type of issue. And it's very peculiar. And it appears to be part of, as I was saying before, part of that agenda to divide and conquer by encouraging the more intolerant extremist aspects of certain protected minorities, or just turning a blind eye to them, ignoring them, not commenting upon them, and then treating any clear criticism that is simply based on facts as hate speech and saying how terribly offensive it is. That strategy does appear to be a coordinated strategy that comes from some source of power and control within the West, and that needs to stop. And we need to speak out against that very, very stridently. Because let me just make it very, very clear. Those aspects of Islam which are indisputable and which are part of the governing system of laws in numerous Islamic countries are totally wicked, totally anti-democratic, unacceptable by any standard definition of human rights. They are completely beyond the pale. And I'm talking specifically about things like death to adulterers, death to homosexuals, death to apostates of Islam, death to those who insult Islam. And in many cases, not just death, but we're talking horrific torture. We're talking, in Saudi Arabia, a prominent atheist there was sentenced to 800 lashes, 800 lashes. And following that, after the government, the prosecutors appealed his sentence, he was then sentenced to death in addition to the 800 lashes. 800 lashes and having your head chopped off for being an atheist. Okay? That is unacceptable. There is a woman who is scheduled to be stoned to death, a Sri Lankan housemaid in Saudi Arabia who is scheduled to be stoned to death. These things are completely unacceptable, and the lack of a voice within the Western media, and it's more important that it should be in the Western media than even among Islamic groups, because first of all, we are the people who need to speak out. We in the West, who are the upholders of Western liberal democracy, need to be the ones standing up in a very strong, bold and clear voice to say, this is completely wrong and completely unacceptable. And the fact that we don't do that, and the fact that many liberal-minded people, many left-wing type of people, are reluctant to ever bring this up for fear of being offensive to the culture of Islam, is only fostering and encouraging these wicked elements of that culture and giving them the green light. So this has to stop. And I will certainly make it very, very clear on this show that I think such things are unacceptable, and I don't cower before some fear of offending Islam. I don't fear simply speaking the truth because it might offend a culture, if that culture is endorsing utterly inhumane, barbaric practices. But that does not mean that I will then infer that that entire culture and every aspect of it is thereby tainted and irredeemable. Because that, again, is the language and polemic of war, of a clash of civilizations, which could lead to really the end of the world as we know it. So that is something that we must at all costs avoid. My desire is to reach out, to find a form of dialogue, to find out who's there within this group of people, within this culture, that doesn't go along with these extremist Sharia precepts. And if you look, you will find, and I have done a bit of digging, and I found that there are very significant groups within Islam that are working deliberately, systemically, to change the culture within Islam and to promote the culture that is more akin to what we understand and what we appreciate in the West as the separation of church and state, as a recognition that religion is a private choice to be adopted by individuals or communities, but religious precepts or theocratic dictates are not part of civil society. And I will actually just read to you now from Huffington Post. The world's largest Islamic organization tells ISIS to get lost. A 50 million strong Sunni movement in Indonesia just launched a global anti-extremist campaign. And this is actually from the 3rd of December 2015, so it's quite current. Each time the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, or another terrorist group commits violence in the name of Islam, a familiar refrain arises. What is the Muslim world doing about it? In fact, anti-extremist efforts abound in the global Muslim community. Muslim leaders and scholars have denounced the Islamic State group. The UK's Muslim Youth League has declared ideological holy war against extremism. And YouTube has even tried to recruit American Muslims to counter extremist content. And in Indonesia, home of the world's largest Muslim population, a massive anti-extremism movement is underway. Nadlatul Ulama, or NU, is the largest independent Islamic organization in the world, with 50 million members. Part Sunni religious body, part political body, and part charity, it was founded nearly 90 years ago, in 1926, as a response to another Sunni movement, Wahhabism. Wahhabism is the ultra-conservative reform movement based in Saudi Arabia that advocates for puritanical laws from the time of Islam's origins. It rejects the modern notion of religion as a purely private activity and the separation of church and state. The Islamic State is committed to Wahhabi principles, using its religious textbooks and embracing its hardline tradition of killing unbelievers. NU's stated goal is to spread messages about a tolerant Islam in their respective countries to curb radicalism, extremism, and terrorism, which it claims often spring from a misinterpretation of Islamic teachings. Now, as I said before, one of the main foci of this group is to look at the central concepts of political philosophy behind Wahhabi-influenced doctrines and to redefine Muslim society more along the lines of the Western principles of freedom of religion and religion as a private choice. We are going to break. I'll continue with this when we come back. Very important discussion. Stay with us. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. And just continuing here from this article that was published on Huffington Post about a week ago, it turns out that Indonesia is home to a very, very large liberal Muslim organization. And they are trying to change the perception of Muslim, of Islam. And this is actually based on the way Islam functions in Indonesia, particularly in Java. And I'll just read you here from the article. Indonesia is home to one of the most liberal Muslim populations in the world. Now, although Indonesian Muslims are a numerical majority, they live alongside Hindus and Buddhists who predated them on the island, that's the island of Java, and they share and mix spiritual traditions. Indonesia's national motto is Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, or unity in diversity, and that ethos is central to the country's Muslim traditions. It is the backdrop for the school of Islam Nusantara, Islam of the Archipelago, a 500-year-old strain of Sunnism that emphasizes Hindu-Buddhist tenets like non-violence and religious tolerance. In a 90-minute film released by NU called The Divine Grace of Islam Nusantara, Indonesian Islamic scholars systematically criticize and denounce the Islamic State's interpretation of the Quran and the Hadith. Now, this is really, really important, folks, because there's a lot of polemic going on. There's a lot of attack going on against Islam on a generic level. And people within the alternative media, as much as the mainstream media, are not doing enough work to really research this, to really understand what's going on. It would be like defining Christianity by just a blanket statement about what Christianity is. And you could easily raise many examples to defend such a view, but it would be shallow and dishonest to pitch the idea that Christianity is purely represented by those dominant aspects of it that we see in the media. You've got to dig, you've got to understand, you've got to put some effort, because this is a vast culture. This is a culture of around about 1.5 billion people. So it is not something that can be simply pushed away and treated as like some gangrene that has to be excised from the body of humanity. You cannot do that. And it really upsets me that so many people on the internet are apparently taking that position. So I will be taking a look at that film, and I will continue to talk about this, and I will continue to try to encourage dialogue. We need to be speaking with truly moderate Muslims. And I'm saying that not just in a token sense. Many people think moderate Muslims are just pretending. They think, oh, moderate Muslims don't themselves want to engage in violence, but they turn a blind eye to those who do. This is kind of the meme that's being put forth about moderate Islam. And it basically taints everyone. It says they're all no good. And see, that's intolerance in itself. That type of intolerance is actually almost as bad as what the Islamic State are doing. Because once you have that attitude set in your mind, you dehumanize those people and you would justify committing crimes against them. It's very reminiscent of what happened in Nazi Germany in World War II. And as we all know, some of the criticisms of Jews that the Nazis engaged in were correct. And the Jews did hold a lot of power. They did control a lot of finance, and some of that influence was and still is quite negative in the world. But of course, once you turn that into an anti-Semitic political philosophy and say, well, this entire group of people is thereby tainted, then you become the enemy. You become a bad person yourself. And that's what we have to guard against at all costs. Now, I'd like to move on. I want to play to you a clip from an interview with John Pilger that was on RT recently. John Pilger has been on a show on RT with Ashlan Ratanzi quite a number of times, and he always has a very, very strong and clear perspective about what is going on. And I just want to play to you a little of this clip from RT from about 2 weeks ago, Everything the West Has Done to Create ISIS. And this is the other side of the picture, which we must always keep in focus, is the fact that these Western imperial powers consciously use Islamic State as a weapon. And underlying that, they use the philosophy behind Islamic State, which is far more than just that one group. It is the philosophy which drives Saudi Arabia and is very dominant in Iran and many other countries. They use that, they foster it, they protect it, they refuse to criticize the underlying philosophy. And when people come forward to simply make the observation that this is a gross abuse of human rights, you're told you're being insulting to another culture. How dare you? Could it be that all of these aspects have been engineered? Let's play a little of the interview on RT with John Pilger.
With me is one of the world's greatest journalists who knows better than most about the impact of imperial wars, from Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos to the British Labour Party's catastrophic wars on Afghanistan and Iraq, and to David Cameron's destruction of the richest country in Africa, Libya. His new film, American Power in the Asia Pacific, and its new challenge from China, is out next year. John Pilger, thanks for coming back on Going Underground. So how are ISIS the progeny of Washington, London and Paris?
Oh, they are not only the progeny, they are the fully grown-up, manic, adolescent creature belonging to Paris, London, Obama, and the United States. Without the support of these three countries, without the arms that have been given to ISIS, either they've been given directly to Jabhat al-Nusra and have gone to ISIS, or they've gone the other way, or they've gone to the Wahhabists in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, but the French, the British, the Americans and the Turks have all supplied those who have kept ISIS going. You know, if David Cameron had won his Commons vote a couple of years ago, ISIS would now be in charge in Syria. In other words, the Middle East's most multi-ethnic, multicultural state would be finished, and these fanatics would be in charge, and that would be thanks entirely to Western actions. Western actions that are reinforced by our propaganda. Propaganda is so powerful now. I've never known really a time when propaganda has played such an important part. And that includes 2003, when propaganda allowed Blair to go ahead with Bush and invade Iraq. I mean, here we have this orchestrated hysteria following the terrible events in Paris, being reported so selectively, so rapaciously. Just now, The Guardian has admitted that it suppressed comment that might suggest that Western policies had something at all to do with ISIS and the attacks on Paris. And we know that Cameron has ignored everything that Blair was told by all the intelligence and security agencies, from MI6 all the way through. We had the former ambassador, Oliver Miles, saying that, just reeling off all those government institutions that warned Blair that if he attacked Iraq, then it would come back, there would be blowback.
You're with Truth News Radio Australia, just playing you an interview with John Pilger on RT. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I was just playing to you there a clip of John Pilger talking about the ISIS situation. I might just leave it there because I'll put the link to that on the website and you can listen to the rest of it at your leisure. I want to actually play another clip now, and I want to interject with a bit of my own commentary. And this is actually the President of the United States, his address to the nation after the terrible atrocity that occurred recently in California, which has now been linked to terrorism, although the individuals concerned have no specific terrorist links. They just were influenced by the ideas behind the hatred of America. I want to play Obama's speech, and I will stop it at a few points just to give a little bit of perspective on what is actually being said. So here we go.
Good evening. On Wednesday, 14 Americans were killed as they came together to celebrate the holidays. They were taken from family and friends who loved them deeply. They were white and black, Latino and Asian, immigrants and American-born, moms and dads, daughters and sons. Each of them served their fellow citizens, and all of them were part of our American family. Tonight, I want to talk with you about this tragedy, the broader threat of terrorism, and how we can keep our country safe. The FBI is still gathering the facts about what happened in San Bernardino, but here's what we know. The victims were brutally murdered and injured by one of their co-workers and his wife. So far, we have no evidence that the killers were directed by a terrorist organization overseas or that they were part of a broader conspiracy here at home. But it is clear that the two of them had gone down the dark path of radicalization, embracing a perverted interpretation of Islam that calls for war against America and the West. They had stockpiled assault weapons, ammunition, and pipe bombs. So this was an act of terrorism.
I just want to pause it there because he says this was an act of terrorism, and yet these individuals were not connected to any group. That's now the official position. There seems to be a problem there of definition, a problem of semantics almost, because by definition, terrorism is a political strategy. If these individuals were not connected to any political group, then how are they different to the serial killers and the mass killers which have erupted in American society for many, many decades, who are always driven by some sort of hatred of people, hatred of society, hatred of, you know, Ted Bundy hated girls with long hair parted in the middle, right? He was on a terrorist campaign to basically eliminate young women with hair parted in the middle. There is no there's absolutely no difference except that perhaps the ideas that these people had may be shared in some respect by others, but because it's not systematized, it's no different really to, again, you know, the many violent men who are out there who take out their rage against women, right? It's similar ideas. They're driven by similar ideas. They've got anger against women. So they rape and beat and murder women. But they're not connected to any group, but they are driven by some sort of ideology which is shared. I'm simply trying to highlight the fact that using the word terrorism is just a label which clearly has political significance and value for Obama in this context, because it allows him to get up on the soapbox and make some pronouncements. But it's ludicrous. It's just another act of random violence that we see so much of in the United States that is a product of so many things. I mean, the society itself creates this type of extremist response in a certain number of people. And, you know, if you want to fix that, you've got to look at what's gone wrong with the society, because It pops up in all different shapes and sizes, colors and ethnic groups. If you treat it as some sort of military conflict, then you will only make it worse. That's my opinion. Anyway, back to Mr. Obama.
Designed to kill innocent people. Our nation has been at war with terrorists since Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 Americans on 9/11. In the process, we've hardened our defenses, from airports to financial centers to other critical infrastructure. Intelligence and law enforcement...
Okay, I have to just pause it there. Al-Qaeda killed 3,000 people. That makes it sound like Al-Qaeda kind of went out into the street with machine guns and murdered thousands of people, just mowed them down, or, you know, threw hand grenades into restaurants and just, you know, got the kill up, you know, the count up. Whereas, in fact, we know that the vast majority, like 2,700 of those deaths, were caused by the totally unexpected collapse of two buildings which were designed to withstand the impacts of a jet airliner, and indeed which the fire department and the police department had such faith in that they sent several hundred of their own people into the building to deal with the problem, because no one expected those buildings to collapse. Now, no one expected them to collapse, right? So Al-Qaeda could not legitimately have expected them to collapse unless they were either crazy or had some inside knowledge of why that would be the case that was better than the fire department. I'm simply trying to make the point that the claim that Al-Qaeda killed 3,000 people is spurious at best. What killed 2,700 people was the still unexplained and mysterious collapse of the World Trade Center. And we still have not had a proper investigation into that collapse, as well as the collapse of the building across the road at 5:20 that afternoon. We have had no explanation that makes any sense. We've had big fat reports written by government bodies, but we've had no explanation of how that's even possible. Again, I'll return you to President Obama.
Enforcement agencies have disrupted countless plots here and overseas and worked around the clock to keep us safe. Our military.
Okay, I have to interrupt again. The countless plots that have been foiled by the FBI are, in every single case that I know of, have actually been cases of FBI stings where the FBI has an informant on the inside or cultivates somebody through inducements, through direct offers of money to take steps towards some sort of terrorist act. And then they swoop and then they make a huge media blitz about how they foiled another terrorist threat. So again, this is completely false. Let's just call it false and move on. Here we go.
And counterterrorism professionals have relentlessly pursued terrorist networks overseas, disrupting safe havens in several different countries, killing Osama bin Laden.
Again, I have to interject. What they've done is they've launched a Predator drone program which kills up to 90% of the people killed are not the targeted individuals, and that's from insiders, from whistleblowers, from within the drone program. And certainly they're being disruptive on some level, but they don't really have a very clear idea of what it is they've even achieved, because basically they're just targeting somebody on the basis of a mobile phone which might be in a person's possession, and they're saying that because that person who has the phone was blown up, that threat is now eliminated. That's their proof. That's the level of proof they use. And that's what Obama is referring to as his great success in disrupting terrorist networks. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back.
Happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? And at that point...
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm just going to continue playing here a clip from President Obama talking a number of furphies in regard to the great strides that the United States has made in suppressing terrorism. Here we go. And I will continue with my commentary as we speak.
And decimating al-Qaeda's leadership. Over the last few years, however, the terrorist threat has evolved into a new phase. As we've become better at preventing complex, multifaceted attacks like 9/11, terrorists turn to less complicated acts of violence, like the mass shootings that are all too common in our society. It is this type of attack that we saw at Fort Hood in 2009, in Chattanooga earlier this year, and now in San Bernardino. And as groups like ISIL grew stronger amidst the chaos of war in Iraq and then Syria, and as the internet erases the distance between countries, we see growing efforts by terrorists to poison the minds of people like the Boston Marathon bombers and the San Bernardino killers. For 7 years, I have confronted this evolving threat each and every morning in my intelligence briefing. And since the day I took this office, I have authorized U.S. forces to take out terrorists abroad precisely because I know how real the danger is. As Commander-in-Chief, I have no greater responsibility than the security of the American people. As a father to two young daughters who are the most precious part of my life, I know that we see ourselves with...
Okay. I have to interject. He, as Commander-in-Chief, has authorized the CIA to assassinate individuals, which he's calling terrorists. And this is to make us safe. But the Predator drone program is probably one of the single most recruiting mechanisms that violent militant Islam has in the world because it is so inhumane and so criminal. And is so completely outside of concepts of international law that it is acts like these drone killings which probably inspired the people in San Bernardino to go on a killing rampage themselves. It certainly would justify it to them. I mean, we're dealing here with deceit on a satanic level, ladies and gentlemen. We are dealing here with a complete perversion and a disgusting perversion of facts representing something the opposite of what it truly is. I don't think I can even play any more of it. It looks good on a very surface level, you know, and you listen to the words, you listen to the tone, it all sounds very good, but you analyze any segment of what is actually being said, and it is completely false. It is really scary, ladies and gentlemen. I find it scary to actually even contemplate how evil these people indeed have become. I'll just leave it with you. I'll put the link there, obviously, to that address. There's more in it that certainly is worth note. At one point, Obama says that nobody who is on a no-fly list should be able to buy a gun. I mean, and that's one of the most laughable things he says in the entire speech. Nobody on a no-fly list should be able to buy a gun. There were like 3 million on that 10 years ago. I mean, the no-fly list was just a kitchen sink of anyone that the Homeland Security thought... you know, didn't like. I mean, Ted Kennedy was on it. Ted Kennedy was on the no-fly list. I mean, the fact that Obama blithely says that we should just basically ban everyone on a no-fly list from getting a gun. Words fail me, ladies and gentlemen. It is very, very disturbing. And this man is certainly not the leader of the free world. I don't know what he is the leader of. It's very scary to even contemplate what he is, in fact, the spokesperson of. Anyway, I've got something more to cover before we get to the end of the show today. I want to return to vaccines in Australia because it's very important to understand with this ongoing war on anti-vaccine groups in Australia that there appears to be plans afoot to bring the new no jab, no pay laws into more than just provisions to protect children. And that's largely because the age range now that is covered by the no jab, no pay laws go up to the age of 19, and a person is considered adult at the age of 18. So you as a parent are responsible for your child's vaccination schedule right up to the age of 19. And the information is being placed on a vaccination register. It was originally called the Childhood Registration Vaccine Register. It is now called just the Vaccine Register. And it is a data collection technology that everyone's details are going to be put on. And indeed, it affects the generation who are young now, who are being born now, because all of them will go on this register. There will be no exceptions. I mean, in a way, the register itself is perhaps the most chilling Orwellian aspect of these new anti-vaccine laws, because this is just a massive data collection program. And they're going to have detailed records on people's vaccination schedules right up to the age of 19. And if you think they're going to stop at that point and not take any interest in what happens after the age of 19, well, you know, I'll sell you some land on Mars. The only reason they're doing it, the only reason they'd put that amount of effort into it is because they intend to roll this out as a lifelong system. It is the vaccination register, and they've already set the precedent of denying all kinds of privileges to people within society for not conforming to the recommended vaccine schedule. But the recommended vaccines do not stop at the age of 19. As you all know, every year there is a recommended flu vaccine. And sometimes when certain disease epidemics come out, they recommend that parents should get a shot of a whooping cough vaccine or a measles booster or all of these different types of things. So there's all kinds of booster shots that you might want to get. It would be foolish and stupid and ignorant not to recognize that what is planned here is a system of total control of the population through this register and through laws that certainly may not be limited to denying tax rebates. There are all kinds of other things the tax department could do, by the way, if they want to use the ATO as their weapon. They could deny refunds of any kind. You know, every year the average Australian worker who has tax-deductible expenses can get quite a lot of deductions, and that's money you have to beg back from the government. But they could easily say, well, you know, you didn't get your flu shot last year, so, sorry, until you get the flu shot, you don't get your tax refund this year. It's easy. This is what's coming, folks. This is what's coming. And anyone who doesn't see this as an obscene attack on our freedom and our liberty as a society, I just boggles my mind how such people can exist, and yet I know they are perhaps the majority within Australian society. Now, on that note, I just want to draw your attention to something that I recently discovered it was floating around the internet, it's been around the internet for a long time. Mahatma Gandhi was a very strident opponent of vaccines, and he wrote a book, A Guide to Health, which has just really, really passionate and strong statements about why people should not get vaccinated, why they should oppose vaccines at all costs. And bear in mind that Gandhi was a man who grew up through the period which is the most renowned period in the history of immunization, which was the eradication of smallpox, which is a glowing story of success according to the official histories. And yet it is specifically in relation to the smallpox vaccine that Gandhi developed his views. And we are just getting towards the end of the hour here, but I'll put a link to it on the show. I've just got an article here from greenmedinfo.com which summarises some of the main points from his book. Key points. The nature of diseases like smallpox have been misconceived. While smallpox has a contagious component, vaccinated individuals can become infected and non-vaccinated individuals remain immune, disproving Jenner's original theory that vaccination equates to bona fide immunity. And that's such an incredibly important point. It's something that vaccine critics continually raise, and it was also the case back 100 years ago in relation to the smallpox vaccine. Isn't that fascinating? Vaccination is an unsanitary practice. By injecting the filth of a diseased cow and smallpox patient into the body of a healthy individual, one inevitably makes them sicker, possibly producing new infections, ultimately resulting in a greater disease burden. And again, this is something we've seen again and again with vaccines in the West, is that disease epidemics are often caused by vaccines themselves. The route of administration of the vaccine, injection, harbours special dangers versus natural oral exposures to infection. Quite a number of other points here. And very interesting point here. The income generated through vaccination is the driving reason why the medical profession does not wish to identify the aforementioned problems. So the profit motive, again, was something that was enforced back then. That is the end of our show for this week, ladies and gentlemen. It has been really a great honour talking to you, and I will be back next week with Truth News Radio Australia. See you then.